From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Public trust in the federal government of the United States has been low for years now, but during the coronavirus pandemic, it fell even lower. Just 20% of Americans, as per the latest Pew survey in fall 2020, said they trusted Washington to do the right thing, just about always or most of the time. My guest writes that in spite of the dangers of mistrust in institutions, the loss of public faith can be an important first step in transforming those institutions for the better. Ethan Zuckerman is the founder of the Institute for Digital Public Infrastructure at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, an associate professor of public policy, information and communication. His new book is called simply Mistrust: Why Losing Faith in Institutions Provides the Tools to Transform Them. Welcome to the program, Ethan.
It's so great to be with you, Sonali.
So your book references Donald Trump's first election, and I want to quote from that because I feel like that's a good place to start, because for years we've been trying to understand why Trump won that electoral college vote. You say, "The election of a man with no governmental experience and no apparent interest in the functioning of a federal government to the nation's highest office suggests the deep alienation of a large percentage of the American electorate. Trump was elected by people who had lost faith in the government's ability to meet their needs and to make meaningful change. That the change he promised was primarily the return of white men to positions of authority and power can disguise the fact that many people of all political stripes were unhappy with the status quo." Now, we do, of course, not want to undermine the fact that it was basically a huge part of the movement that brought him to power was built on racism. But why is it important for us to understand that that loss of trust in government informed his election?
So I think it's important that we understand that Trump is really the end of a very long process rather than a unique figure on his own. So you cited that figure that fewer than 20% of Americans trust the government to do the right thing all or most of the time. One of the things that I was most struck by in my research was that in 1964, when you asked Americans that same question, 77% of them said they trusted the government. And so there's been an enormous change, but the change actually started happening a long time ago. It started happening during the 1970s. Trust fell enormously through the Vietnam War, through Watergate, through the energy crisis. It's recovered at different times, more recently to now. But honestly, trust in government has been extremely low, not just through the Trump presidency, but through the entire Obama presidency, through much of George W. Bush's presidency. And it's not just trust in government, it's trust in institutions of all sorts. When you ask Americans whether they trust the church, the medical system, banks, big business, all of these different institutions, trust has fallen in one fashion or another. So I was really interested if there was an explanation for Donald Trump's rise that also helped us understand a movement like Occupy. It's hard to remember in some ways, but during the Obama presidency, we had people occupying public spaces to point out that America's particular blend of representative democracy and late-stage capitalism is leading to utterly crippling inequality and reduced social mobility, and is a system that's frankly not working for a lot of people. And what I ended up suggesting is that at a moment where there's very low trust in institutions, someone who promises radical change, someone who promises moving away from institutionalism and incrementalism, has a real advantage at the ballot box. And unfortunately, that's part of what happened with Donald Trump.
How much of this mistrust is fueled by our information age? On the one hand, we have a lot more information at our fingertips now than we had before, which can be a good thing because, you know, we can see the ways in which our politicians let us down, corporate CEOs let us down. There's all this information that one can find. It's easy to share that information, and fueling a sort of legitimate mistrust may stem from that. On the other hand, We also have enormous amounts of disinformation that fuels the mistrust, that can be sort of destructive to institutions that are worth keeping.
So again, this is why it's important to have a bit of a historical view on this. If this shift in trust had happened since, you know, let's say 2006, where Facebook sort of comes on the scene and we have model social networking, if it happened only in those last 15 years, having a much more open internet-based media would be a good source of primary cause. But remember, it's a much older shift. It's a shift that starts in many ways in the 1970s and sort of comes back in waves. And at that point, I think you can look at information. I think you can also look at education. There's a huge surge in the United States in the percentage of people who have a university level education, who finished high school, who are more experienced with doing the work of critical thinking. I think that comes into play. I think inequality, as I suggested before, is an enormous factor on this. We've seen a huge shift from the 1960s to the present, where America has become profoundly more unequal. And then finally, I think there are different institutions that have had their own individual failings. When we look at mistrust in the church, for instance, that follows on the heels of the Catholic sex scandal that's exposed by the Boston Globe. Now, all of that said, there is absolutely something going on right now with mis and disinformation, particularly coming from conspiracies like Stop the Steal and QAnon. And what we've seen under the Trump presidency is a weaponization of mistrust, which is actually quite surprising. Usually when someone takes higher office, what they end up saying is, okay, I'm in control now, I've got the reins, trust us, we're going to do good stuff. Trump does not say that. He actually ends up saying something very different. I'm here, I am the only one you can trust, the entire system is corrupt, it's not just the media, it's the deep state, it's all against you. And he is therefore able to take that sort of organic mistrust that people have, you know, perhaps legitimately from systems that are failing them, and really expand it and weaponize it. And by channeling it through this really toxic cocktail of white supremacy and racism, is able to turn it into violence. So it is certainly true that mis and disinformation has a role in all of this. But I think people who look at our current political moment and say, if we could just get back to a pre-internet moment, if we could just control the information environment, they're actually missing a much deeper trend. American citizens are really very different than we were in the 1960s. We are much, much less inclined to trust our institutions, and that points to a need for very different relationships between citizens and their institutions.
One of the trends that you bring up over the last few years as an example of how mistrust has fueled, you know, positive transformation is the Me Too movement. Tell me a little bit about that. You know, it's not as though women have only now been assaulted and harassed and, you know, kept down because of men having power over them. It's just now that they're speaking out. So how do you fit that phenomenon in your thesis?
A big part of what I'm talking about in mistrust is ways to make trust, ways to make change in institutions that does not rely on trusting those institutions, right? So an institutionalist version of change says, we've got to go to our corporate HR department, we need more training on sexual harassment, you know, we need to change the way that we handle these things. I think many people who have faced sexual harassment in the workplace understand that it's extremely difficult to get most institutions to recognize and to support sexual harassment claims. It's a problem in which institutions often work to protect themselves. So mistrust in many ways looks at this question of what are multiple pathways towards change. One pathway towards change is working to change social norms. So you're absolutely right. Women have been facing harassment and assault in the workplace probably since the dawn of time. we have seen a norms-based change where women are becoming increasingly willing to talk about the harassment that they faced, in part because of the support that they are getting from other women and also from allies in online spaces. And that in turn is helping change a norm around sexual assault from something that we don't discuss to something that we do discuss. There was not a great legal change that happened around sexual harassment that led to Harvey Weinstein's ouster. What there was a norms-based change in which the ways in which we talk about sexual harassment and the ways in which we are willing to challenge serial sexual harassers changes. And that in turn can change power dynamics quite dramatically. Many of the people who were most important in making the Me Too movement, you know, find traction were people like Alyssa Milano, who had a great deal of reach. This in no way detracts from the women who have been involved with the movement much, much longer, but that ability to make change through changing many hearts and minds is something that often works by harnessing celebrity. And I don't think it's a surprise that it was within celebrity-based institutions like the movies, like media, in which Me Too started having its largest impact.
There's also deep mistrust, justifiable mistrust of police and our criminal justice system. And we saw the Black Lives Matter movement go national in this early summer of 2020, even though it had been around for a lot longer than that. Is that a similar trend?
Yeah. So when I have been talking about mistrust and I've been talking about what a productive insurrectionist movement could look like, defund the police is the chief example that I've been using. And the reason I'm using this is that what insurrectionists in many cases are saying is that we are facing an institution that has claimed to be changing, has been claimed to be making these small incremental changes for years and years and years, and we simply don't trust it anymore to make those changes. Whether it's in Minneapolis, whether it's in Baltimore, whether it's in other cities that have horrific relationships between police and people of color, this has not come out of nowhere, right? There have been reform efforts for many, many decades. And what might need to happen in a city like Minneapolis is a radical rethinking of what policing looks like, where there are far fewer people who are carrying weapons and who can potentially violently respond to an incident, and many more people who are essentially professional community workers and social workers who are working to defuse. So when we talk about defunding a system, I read that as essentially saying, look, we've looked at this institution, and in this community, due to its particular history, it's simply not fit for purpose at present. And we need to reimagine something radically different. What I think is so powerful about Black Lives Matter is not the fact that it is, as you suggested, a norms-based movement. It has been very successful at suggesting that systemic racial bias is something that we simply have to have in our heads to understand the relationship between police and community of colors. But it's also a movement about imagining different possibilities. And that's in fact what's so exciting to me. I think in many cases where institutions are failing us, our main failure is one of imagination. We are simply not being creative and imaginative enough at how radically an institution could change. We get told by very serious people that the only possible changes are really small and incremental. And in cases like criminal justice, that's just not enough in many communities.
You used the word insurrectionists, which is, of course, very much in the public discourse right now regarding the January 6th riot. And literally the word insurrection is in the article of impeachment that Trump was is facing. And the people that overran the Capitol on January 6th truly believed that the election was stolen from them, from
That's
Trump.
True.
So Do you worry that this idea of disruption can transform into a violent disruption of the kind that we saw on January 6th? Because the only response to what happened there seems to be an institutional response.
So I worry enormously. And so let me try to unpack the term a little bit. I ended up borrowing the term from Chris Hayes, the commentator and author, television host. He wrote a very thoughtful book called Twilight of the Elites. He talked about a shift in American politics where we don't just talk about left and right, but we also talk about institutionalist and insurrectionist. And the way that he means the terms are that institutionalists are people who believe that we make change by joining within an institution and helping to steer it, probably a little bit at a time. Whereas insurrectionists look at those institutions and say, this is no longer fit for purpose. Either I need to work from the outside and sort of push against the institution, or I might need to actually try to create another institution in its place or tear down this institution and rebuild in a way that's more just and more fair. I don't think either Hayes or I were thinking about people storming the Capitol when we ended up using those terms. In some ways, it's so unthinkable that it makes it possible to use that term. Obviously, now at this point, you know, you find yourself talking about this question of insurrection and what's the difference between wanting to change a broken system and using violence and terror to do so. So the people who overtake the Capitol on January 6th are not the people that I'm celebrating in this book, or really the people that I'm talking about. In many ways, what they're trying to do is a deeply conservative change, right? They're not trying to change how the institution works so much as they are trying to ensure that someone remains in power. In the process, they might be trying to smash those institutions, including the institution of the Electoral College. What's so complicated about it is that some of those institutions are genuinely broken. The Electoral College actually does not work very well for us at this particular moment in American democracy. This is what gets so tricky about this. Because racist far-right terrorists have sort of put insurrection on the table, our very natural response is to go institutionalist, right? This is what happened in 2016 when Trump got elected. You saw a lot of people on the left rooting for institutions to be strong and resilient in the face of his presidency. You saw dyed-in-the-wool leftists become fans of the FBI when James Comey, you know, found a way to stand up for Donald Trump. In the long run, it is really dangerous for us to stop being critical of those institutions. These institutions, in many cases, are things that we should be deeply frustrated by and deeply skeptical of. And so for me, one of the cautions that I would sort of urge is that even as we process January 6th and we sort of process the violence done to the nation, we don't let go of the need to be very skeptical and very critical of institutions that have been failing us for a long time.
One of the institutions is the media, especially corporate mainstream media, which of course Trump very successfully garnered the mistrust of. And it's interesting to see how we are now seeing this fawning relationship between reporters attending White House press briefings, of Jen Psaki, the Biden press secretary, because they, I think, are so relieved at not having to face Kayleigh McEnany or Sarah Huckabee Sanders, or before her, Sean Spicer, those merchants of Trump's lies. I think it was Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting that sort of reminded reporters that you're supposed to have an oppositional relationship, even if this is a Democratic administration that has returned to, you know, just the decorum that you rely on to do your job.
Yeah, we're so desperate for normalcy right now. The danger is that the press lets down its guard. The danger is that progressives let down our guard, that people who demand change, say, well, at least we're not dealing with the nonsense that we were dealing with during the Trump administration. I think this is why I do find myself coming back to moments like Occupy or Podemos in Spain, this sort of recognition that even if we have someone who, you know, nominally leans to the left, and it's not, you know, entirely clear how far left Biden actually leans, but even if we have someone who is significantly to the left of Donald Trump, we still owe it to ourselves to sort of ask questions about the systems that are in place. We know that many aspects of how America currently works are not working very well for people. And it's very easy to get sort of lost in conversations about, you know, should we be getting $600 or $2,000 in fiscal stimulus? And not asking these real questions like, why are we the only advanced nation that doesn't have guaranteed healthcare? Why is our social safety net so often people running GoFundMe campaigns rather than having a believable system to fall back on? Even when we do have systems designed to help people, why do they often fail so badly? And we find ourselves facing crises like homelessness in California. So I think this is a book that's trying very hard to fight against complacency and to try to ask people where the cases where working within existing institutions is helpful to you, and where are cases where what we really need to do is say that these institutions just aren't working very well anymore, and we need to start imagining and building radically different ways of building new systems.
That brings me to the question of the Wall Street Bets and GameStop controversy, where a number of people on Reddit in a collective way decided to undercut the short selling of GameStop shares and, you know, caused at least one in hedge fund investor to lose billions, and a significant number of them did make money. That seemed to be a sort of using the institution's tools against the institution itself approach, but also reflecting this deep mistrust of Wall Street and the money makers at Wall Street, because, you know, much of America cheered on those people and wondered, well, how can I jump on the gravy train and, you know, stick it to the man, which is it's a legitimate desire.
So it's absolutely true that Wall Street Bets was a great example of financial populism at work. And everybody loves the story of the 15-year-old kid who took his lawn mowing money and, you know, turned it into tens of thousands and then ended up donating a lot of it. Or, you know, the more anonymous figures who cashed out their 401ks and ended up making a fortune off of this. Unfortunately, it's very likely that there were as many professional investors who watched the rally, bet skillfully, and got out before the bubble burst, who actually did significantly better than some of the small investors who came in when that stock was already overvalued. Here's the difference between populism and the sort of insurrectionism that I'm trying to encourage. Populism sort of looks and says, let's find a way to stick it to the man. The movements that I'm really interested in say, wait a second, this system is just messed up. And maybe we need a tax on transactions, as Elizabeth Warren has suggested, where it isn't so easy to manipulate the market. We need to be careful that as much as we celebrate populist movements like Wall Street Bets, that we understand that what we really need to be looking for is long-term change of these systems, because these systems in many cases have been exploiting small investors for 20 or 30 years. What would be much more exciting than sticking it to a hedge fund would be seeing systemic change within the markets.
I want to thank you so much, Ethan, for joining us today. Good luck with your book.
Thank you so much, Sonali. It's a great pleasure to be with you and really enjoyed talking with you.
My guest has been Ethan Zuckerman, founder of the Institute for Digital Public Infrastructure at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, associate professor of public policy, information, and communication. We've been discussing his new book, Mistrust, Why Losing Faith in Institutions Provides the Tools to Transform Them. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.